Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, I'm Hub Arkish, and along with Eric Edholm, it is our pleasure to welcome you to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week of the season and the offseason, we bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors before they happen.
We talk about what some of the NFL's quarterbacks are doing this offseason and make our final preparations for next week's NFL draft.
It's all just ahead on this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. I am Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor here, along with senior editor and my co-host Eric Edholm. We will have just about everybody on the Pro Football Weekly editorial staff joining us over the next hour or so as we go around the NFL with the latest in way we hear it, all the news scoops and rumors before they happen, as well as draft preparation as we are less than a week away from round one, which will begin Thursday evening, April 28th at about 7 o'clock Eastern time. We will have it all for you on next weekend's show. But for right now, as we have each week over the last 4 or 5 weeks, we will update you to the best of our ability on the NFL labor impasse. And Eric, a couple notable issues arising this week. Now, as we tape, which is late on Thursday afternoon, April 21st, we are still awaiting a ruling from Judge Susan Nelson on the players' request for an injunction to enjoin the NFL owners from locking them out. It is possible that that ruling will have come down by the time somebody hear that show. We expected it by the end of this week. Worst case, it'll be early next week. And so on that, we wait. However, while we wait on that, the third day, or I guess it was actually the fourth day of court-ordered mediation, ended on Wednesday after about 7 hours talks with the announcement that the players and the owners would not talk again until May 16th. And I think that really set a lot of people back as to, well, what could be going on or what could be going so wrong, quite frankly, that the two sides have now decided to take 4 weeks off.
Yeah, I think the two sides agree that they take this break because there were some conflicts in the Arthur Boylan, the judge who's overhearing this, his schedule. But that kind of begs the question for me, if Judge Nelson assigned this case to Boylan, wouldn't you have known the schedule ahead of time? It seems a bit odd that you would give it to a judge who is going to Jamaica or has several other cases or whatever the case may be.
Well, it actually seems inexcusable, and that's why I think a lot of people find it kind of hard to accept. I mean, if there is a sense of urgency here, and if Judge Nelson believes that they should try and settle this thing out of court, she certainly didn't want them to put off conversations for a month when she clearly is going to be forced to issue a very controversial ruling before that. And so it leads to speculation, and let me report, guys, it's nothing more than speculation, that this is something that one or both of the two sides prefer. That they just feel that at this point they're gaining leverage for one reason or another, and that they're going to force her to issue a ruling before there's any more talks. Now, whatever the reason, it's not good news for either side or for the fans, because nothing's going to happen towards a settlement at least until May 16th. Now, beyond that, a very interesting story broke, and I believe it, I want to say, is it David or Dan Kaplan from Sports?
Dan Kaplan,
yep. From Sports Business Journal, that as many as 70, what he called mid-tier level players, have engaged an attorney and are prepared to somehow try and demand a seat at the negotiating or mediation table. Now, this is a very strong and very strange and at this point very confusing report that everybody is trying to get more details on, because the bottom line is that we don't know who these 70 players, A, want to fight with. There is no more union. B, it was clear that the union's vote to decertify was close to unanimous, and it was certainly overwhelming. And C, why now? How did this happen? Is this actually 70 players getting together? Is this a couple players who went out and found a lawyer and the lawyer encouraged them to put together a class? Is it a lawyer who went out and found a couple players and encouraged them to go find other players? My suspicion is it's the last, that it's some lawyer jumping into the fray here, because this does no good for the players. It hurts them tremendously in their bargaining position with the owners, and quite frankly, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm with you on the last point. I always kind of suspected when I first heard this that it wasn't this group of rogue 70 players doing their own unionizing or anything like that. I suspected that a law firm reached out to a few guys. Maybe they had prior relationships with them. There was some question whether this law firm had worked for the NFL before. Not clear if there's any kind of direct correlation between the two. But, yeah, it sounds like the latter. And like you said, it does nothing to help. And this is one of the drawbacks of decertifying. You're no longer a collective group, at least under the traditional definition of the word. And splintering off into things like this can happen. So the voice of these 70 or 30 or whatever the number is, there's some concern about that, gets heard over the rest of the group. And it takes away from their argument right now.
Well, and I thought Mike Vrabel had some very interesting comments because his response, and he didn't even know about this until he was questioned on it on the air somewhere. I'm not sure where he was being questioned. But his response was, well, they already have a seat at the table, and if they don't like the representation they're getting, they need to elect a new executive board. Now, immediately people want to challenge him and say, well, if the union doesn't exist, clearly what happened, at least in the minds of the players, is that when they decertified, the existing executive board became an executive board of this new trade association. And this isn't as complicated as a lot of lawyers on the owner's side want to make it. They can choose a new executive board of their trade association. They can do it any way they want. And that's why the only, you know, I think intelligent speculation here is that this is more about some lawyers sticking their hands in the pie than it really has anything to do with the players.
Yeah, I mean, and I would describe at this stage of his career, Mike Vrabel, I mean, he's still got a lot of name value, but I would say he's a mid-tier player at this point in his career. Ben Lieber, one of the 10 guys on that staff, he's a mid-tier player. Maybe Von Miller, the rookie, comes out to be a future star, but he's a rookie. He's starting from the bottom. So, you know, I feel like, you know, even though it is the Brady, Manning, Breeze lawsuit, I think these guys are also being represented.
Well, and Eric, you know, it's important for us to state here before we go to a quick commercial break. We are Pro Football Weekly. We are reporters here. We have no dog in this race. We just want these guys back at work and on the football field. But you don't have to have a stake in this thing to be able to see, any neutral observer can see, these 70 players have done a tremendous disservice to themselves and to their group of players because this is exactly what the owners and Roger Goodell wanted when the commissioner sent that letter to all the players. He wanted to fracture this group. He clearly has succeeded at some level, and it'll be very curious over the next few days as we discover how much damage has actually been done. We take a quick commercial break. There is football going on, guys. There's going to be a draft next week. We know that. It's still a lot of fun. A lot of teams with a lot of news. We've got it all for you right after this quick commercial break. Welcome back, everybody. Hub Arkish and Eric Edholm bringing you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, and we are now joined by executive editor Dan Arkish. And Dan, amongst your ball clubs, the Green Bay Packers and the San Francisco 49ers, with some interesting decisions to make, different positions for different teams, one out of what seems like ridiculous strength, the other one out of potential tremendous weakness. Let's talk about the Green Bay Packers first. Now, James Starks, the rookie from Buffalo, University of Buffalo, emerged late in the season and the playoffs. They, of course, have their franchise back, or at least a guy who's paid like one, Ryan Grant, who received a lot of money in a long-term contract last offseason, was injured in the first game of the year and missed the season. And then they've got Brandon Jackson, who they invested a second-round pick in, who's going to be a free agent, and John Kuhn, the fan favorite, who's also going to be a free agent. What was a tremendous area of weakness and question marks for this ball club going into their Super Bowl season now looks like an embarrassment of riches.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting because, like you said, Hub, they were perceived as a weakness all of last year, coming up short in key situations, but you know, with Grant coming back and the way Starks came on looking like an every down back, eventually Grant is entering his contract year. I think Starks probably is the featured back of the future. I mean, that is a very potent, potentially potent 1-2 running back punch. The thing is, Jackson and Kuhn are free agents, but the way we hear it, at least one of them is a very good bet to remain a Packer.
Well, Dan, what are the chances that Ryan Grant gets Wally Pitt and a guy like James Starks, who really looked like that big, tall, very talented runner, might, you know, replace him as a starter?
Yeah, I think that that's a possibility, but I think Grant does have a body of work that will make him the featured back, at least for starters. But Starks is going to get lots of carries, and it's going to be real interesting to see how that all pans out.
You know, Dan, I hate to put you on the spot on this, but I did a number of the Packers games on the sidelines for West Woodland Radio, and I will tell you that John Kuhn is too valuable a weapon to let get away. I mean, this guy can do a lot of things. He can be your fullback. He can be your H-back. He can be a running back. He catches the ball out of the backfield. Do you know, did they tender him? Because I would think that they would have wanted to make it difficult for somebody to sign him away.
You know, I can't say for sure. I think he's unrestricted under any event. I could be wrong on that. And I think that from what we hear from our guys, he's going to stick around because, you know, as good a fit as he is in Green Bay, he is just a really kind of a marginal talent. I don't know how much of a calling there would be for him elsewhere. Jackson's a different story. I think in a perfect world, he would welcome more playing time than he figures to get in Green Bay with both Grant and Starks there.
All right, Dan, let's move to San Francisco. From the time that Jim Harbaugh got the job as the head coach, he has touted Alex Smith, the former number one overall pick, as potentially the answer to his quarterback situation. That surprised a lot of people because the relatively new GM, Trent Baalke, never seemed to be on that bandwagon. Now, suddenly comments this week from Baalke that he, and by the way, Alex Smith, a free agent, again, we don't know who's unrestricted and restricted, but at this point, a guy that they're going to have to go re-sign if they want him back. And now Baalke saying, gee, maybe I agree with my head coach. Maybe he should be the answer to our quarterback situation.
Well, I think what Baalke realizes is that Smith remains a valuable option in this offseason of such major uncertainty. I mean, he knows the ropes there, and I really do think that Harbaugh likes Alex Smith. But as we've been saying on more than one occasion on this show, the bottom line is what Alex Smith wants to do. And so it kind of boils down to the ability of Harbaugh and Baalke to do a sales job on Smith, who really, you know, the fan base has just really gotten down on him.
Interesting character. Alex Smith had a lot of games where he looked like the good Donovan McNabb and a lot of games where he looked like the bad Donovan McNabb. I hate to use that analogy, but it's that West Coast offense that they want him to run. He does have some athletic ability, but never really developed the rhythm in that passing game to be a guy you can count on. Dan, thank you much for your help with that. Eric, I want to talk to you about one of your ball clubs, the Dallas Cowboys. Interesting news coming out of Dallas this week that Tony Romo has now stepped up and started to make arrangements to gather all or many of his veteran teammates as he can for informal workouts. Probably still a few weeks away. They're getting a later start than a lot of these teams. But interesting that it is Romo, who's been challenged as a leader, and the qualities of his leadership ability is now stepping up and trying to be the guy who gets this done along with all-pro tight end Jason Witten.
Well, it's a big season for Tony. I mean, you look, he's going to be 31 years old. He's going to get married this year. He's been called out by teammates and opponents and media members alike, fans certainly, and you know whether he can make that jump. He's coming off the broken collarbone he suffered early in the year. Wanted to get back on the field. The Cowboys held him back. They ended up ending his season. And so, you know, health wise he's okay, but I think that the leadership thing is the biggest thing with him. Can he consistently show it? I don't think anyone says that Tony Romo's a bad leader. I just think some people have said that he's not that Drew Brees, Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers guy. So look, you know, I mean, they've got to decide who their future quarterback is going to be. Do they go another 3-4 years with Romo, or do they go in another direction?
Well, Cowboys fans know it well. I'm not sure how general fans around the league realize that Tony Romo, his record during the regular season is what it is, and his playoff record is what it is. Yeah. I want to say 1-4 or 1-5, and he's really struggled to step up. One other question I got to ask you. It was his backup tight end, Jason Witten's backup, Martellus Bennett, who said a few weeks ago he sure hopes John Kitna gets a chance to compete for Romo's job because he loves playing with him. Okay, backup tight end, but I thought it was interesting when All-Pro center Andre Giroux last week asked about it, said, well, he understood where Bennett was coming from. He likes both guys. He hopes they both have a great offseason and that they both come to camp to compete. That's not saying Tony Romo is our quarterback, and this is a guy who works more closely with him than anybody else on the team.
Yeah, that was a little bit surprising. I think he was trying to play both sides in the argument, you know, be a good teammate to everybody sort of thing. But, hey, let's face it. I think Romo still has to win some people over in this situation, and he's got to be able to, you know, come into camp, look strong, and possibly fend off Kitna.
All right, Eric, we take another quick commercial break. Wilkie's up next. Senior editor Mike Wilkling will talk what's going on in the Cleveland Brown War Room right after this. We're back with more Pro Football Weekly as we get ready for the 2011 NFL College Draft, and we will now make a stop in the AFC North with the Cleveland Browns. And Mike Wilkening, our senior editor, covers the Browns for us. And Wilkie, some really interesting, well, I guess to me it's really interesting because this is a team that seems to have found the answer at quarterback in Colt McCoy. And yet Browns GM Tom Heckert, who of course was running the draft in Philadelphia when Donovan McNabb was an All-Pro and they used their first overall pick, the 36th pick in the draft, to draft Kevin Kolb, has now said that sitting there at number 6, it's not a priority, but that he won't rule out in any way the possibility that the Browns draft another quarterback.
Well, in looking at what he said, he also, you know, made it clear that he liked Colt McCoy, that I think the Browns, obviously installing him as the starter for 2011, I think, you know, collectively like Colt McCoy. sort of a way of giving the Browns some options. We certainly know that Mike Holmgren loves quarterbacks. We know that they have looked at quarterbacks. They've looked at Cam Newton. Due diligence, perhaps. I mean, you'd have to think that they're doing their due diligence on a lot of players that they're not going to end up drafting. But this is a franchise led by a guy now in Mike Holmgren, sort of the team president, who, again, has loved quarterbacks. That's his position to develop. And by and large, though, guys, I think it wouldn't surprise me if they added a guy in this draft. I don't think it's early. They've got other needs, wide receiver, defensive end, two that really jump out to me right off the top.
Well, and here's how this strikes me, Mike, because Heckert did say he didn't see him trading up. He doesn't want to give up any of his picks. This sounds to me like one of two things. Either he's positioning for a trade down in the possibility that either Blaine Gabbert or Cam Newton drops down to number six, number one, or two, what he's saying, and I assume it's one of those two guys because there's nobody else you're going to draft as high as number six. I think what he's saying is the possibility that Mike Holmgren thinks either Newton or Gabbert is a future Hall of Famer.
I think you've seized upon a couple of ideas that make a lot of sense, Hub. And I think primarily looking at the first option, this is a team that is going to need multiple starters out of this draft. We talked about receiver. We talked about defensive end. Defensive tackle, I think, is also a need. This is a club that changing defensive fronts, they're going to need at least one defensive lineman, I think, out of this draft to come in and start. Maybe multiple defensive linemen. So I think a trade down in terms of adding more picks would make a lot of sense for the Cleveland Browns.
Well, Wilkie, the Browns are at least one of those teams that have a young quarterback in that position if they so choose. Like you said, they can go with Colt McCoy. They can just bring in some able-bodied veteran to be his backup. And it sounds like McCoy is certainly approaching this as if he's going to be the starter. There was some contact between the club and the Browns with McCoy that did cause them a $50,000 fine, but that's not what I'm talking about. He's helped organize some workouts with his teammates. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, his organized workouts at Austin, Texas. Mohamed Massaquoi wrote on Twitter about it, and this is, I think, a good sign. Heckert addressed it in the press conference Thursday. You like to see a quarterback take leadership of the offense, and I think that we always knew that with Colt McCoy, the intangibles were going to be a strength. He's a guy that knows how to lead. You talked to people last season as he was taking that job and making it his own. There was a lot of respect for a guy that was a rookie playing that position, and he has taken to the role of that position. Now, obviously, a little bit more expected this year, but flashed some nice ability, did some good things, clearly was their best quarterback. I look at this as certainly a positive sign for a team that, again, changing offensive schemes, and they've got a quarterback who clearly is their number one at the helm.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. We will be checking back in with you over the next couple weeks. Next week, of course, our focus completely on the first round of the NFL College Draft. Eric, I want to talk to you about one of your clubs. Again, these off-season voluntary informal workouts are all the rage. And in Washington, very, very impressive. London Fletcher, clearly the leader of that football team, managed to get 22 players out this past Tuesday and then 30 veteran players this past Wednesday. Now, there's a lot of teams with the uncertainty of free agent who don't even have 30 guys under contract. The Redskin group included some, like their quarterback Rex Grossman, who isn't under contract. But this is a team that either is getting great leadership from London Fletcher. It says a lot about the veterans on this roster.
Yeah, I mean, I think Fletcher certainly was the ringleader here. Obviously, some other guys, helped organize things. But just because they got 30 didn't mean they got a nice 11-on-11 situation. They had some funny circumstances out there with Kedrick Golson, about a 310-pound guy, lining up at free safety just to fill a spot. And Maki Kimuatu, the huge nose tackle, the space eater, running routes as a receiver. So obviously, this was just sort of to break a sweat, get some guys organized. But for me, the quarterback thing is most interesting. Obviously, McNabb is probably as good as gone as soon as players are able to move. But John Beck and Rex Grossman, I think Grossman still remains in the mix despite he's a free agent. Those two guys could be competing for a starting job, Hub, and really, they've got to show the leadership now to make the things work in August and September, I think.
Well, and considering everybody's belief that the Redskins are going to draft another quarterback, that John Beck has never played an NFL game. Rex Grossman was the starter late in the season. Didn't play horribly, kept him competitive, and we know that the younger Shanahan likes him a lot. You have to assume minimally he will be re-signed, and I think he is sending a message to the Redskins by showing up here voluntarily, flying up from Florida, by the way, that he wants to continue to be a Washington Redskin. We've got another quick commercial break to get out of the way, then more NFL Way We Hear It in Draft News coming up next. Yes, we are. I'm Hub Arkish, along with Eric Edholm. He's my co-host and our senior editor. I am the publisher and editor at Pro Football Weekly, and we have our entire editorial staff checking in. And right now, we're going to start with Eli Cameron, and Eli covers a multitude of ball clubs, but particularly the Oakland Raiders. And Eli, this is a team that fascinates me because they don't have their pick in the first round. Of course, that went to the Patriots in the Richard Seymour trade 2 years ago. And a lot of people thought they'd be giving up a top five pick after the 8-8 year. I believe it's actually number 17, so it's not as great a loss as it would be if it's number five. I'm sure the Raiders are still happy to be making improvements in the win-loss column. But with their first pick in the second round, you're hearing it's almost certainly it's going to be a quarterback. And that's interesting to me because clearly, Al Davis loves Jason Campbell. Jason Campbell's personal numbers weren't outstanding last year, but the Raiders' one-loss record with him at the helm was pretty good.
Well, they'd like to take a quarterback like Ryan Mallett or Christian Ponder, Colin Kaepernick, something like that, but they don't, like you said, they don't pick until number 48, and there's been a recent rumors that those quarterbacks might be taken off the board sooner. So they're kind of in no man's land here at 48 and without the asset of being able to trade that first-round pick because they just don't have it anymore.
Ryan Mallett to the Raiders, is that not perfect or what? Okay, I mean, he's got the huge arm, he can throw down the field, he's off some boards for characteristics, that makes a ton of sense. Is Hugh Jackson gonna throw the same support behind Jason Campbell he did last year? It seemed like there was a tug of war between Tom Cable and Hugh Jackson, obviously Jackson now the head coach. I mean, do you think he's gonna give him a longer leash than Cable did last season?
I think he will get a longer leash than he did last year, but they're really not sure if Campbell's their quarterback for the future, and that's probably why they want to address that position in the second round. Jackson does support Campbell. He has the mobility and accuracy that he likes, but they'd like to get younger at the position, which is why they might want to take a pick there.
Yeah, the one guy I don't see ending up there is Andy Dalton. There's something about Opie and Al Davis together that just doesn't make a lot of sense. That's no knock on Andy Dalton. This kid has raced up the draft boards with a lot of clubs. Eli, thank you very much. Let's get to Associate Editor Dan Parr, one of Dan's clubs, the Chicago Bears. Dan, no team has struggled more in the NFL college draft in recent years than the Chicago Bears. They've been without a first-round pick the last 2 years, were without a first- and second-round pick last year because of the Gaines-Adams trade. Now they're picking first, although with the 29th pick in the first round, it's like almost like a high second-rounder. But nonetheless, nobody, I guess, was surprised when one of the first things Jerry Angelo said at his annual meeting with the media leading up to the draft, of course we'd consider trading down. I mean, at what point do you think that Angelo and his regime start to take responsibility for the fact that this team is in trouble? Even if they're competitive again this year, the cupboard is bare as far as young talent, and they got to get better in the draft.
There's no question that in terms of young talent, this team has been lacking. And when you trade a couple first-round picks for Jay Cutler, like they did a couple years ago, that really does hinder your ability to bring in and infuse your roster with some younger players. But they'll point to being in the NFC Championship game last year as a sign that they've been successful. Angelo is going to, putting out on the radar for other teams that he would like to trade down at 29. The Patriots right in front of the Bears might be wanting to trade down at number 28. So how much interest is there going to be if the Patriots also make a deal right before them? Could be interesting to see if there's an onslaught of trades at that point in the draft.
Yeah, quick follow-up, Dan. One of the few draft prospects that Angelo mentioned was Marvin Austin from North Carolina. A lot of people think he's rehabbed his image and now could be a first-round pick. If the Bears are unable to move out of the first round, like you said, do you think there's a possibility they would consider Austin a potential great three technique if he can get his act together?
I do think they definitely consider it. Jerry Angelo said that they've done their homework on him, and Lovie Smith was down, and they did some digging at his pro day, and they've taken a good look at him. So they feel like the book on him has been scanned thoroughly, and they feel like they have a good handle on that guy. And Angelo made it a point to say that they're not looking for halo players. They want guys to be solid character guys, but if there are some issues that aren't overly concerning in their past, it's not going to prevent them from taking them in the draft, and we've seen them do that in the past.
And one thing to understand about the Chicago Bears, with some justification, they believe if there's a coach in the NFL who can handle kids like this, it is Rod Marinelli. And Marinelli does have that reputation as rehabbing. A bad character is bad character, but a lot of these kids aren't bad character. They're just immature kids, and Marinelli has developed a lot of them. So that is another reason to keep an eye on Austin. Dan, thank you very much. We'll welcome in another of our associate editors, Arthur Arkish, and Arthur's got the Colts amongst his ball clubs. And, Arthur, it's hard for me to believe that too many other teams around the league are taking Bill Polian all that seriously when he talks about guys like Andy Dalton and Colin Kaepernick with his first or even his second round pick.
Well, there's certainly a good reason that you wouldn't want to believe something like that, of course, with you know, one of the elite quarterbacks in the game, at least under contract or franchise tag for next season. So what we're hearing, and as we know, predicting what Mr. Polian's going to do on draft day is about as inexact of a science as you will find. But he has been known for putting out smoke signals, so this could be another one of those cases. The Colts are also very adept at looking 1 year down the road. So while Peyton is locked up with that franchise tag for next season, it's not out of the realm of possibility that Mr. Polian wants to maybe perhaps gain a little bit of leverage by at least looking at these guys and considering them with that pick.
I mean, also, we've seen the Ron Wolf school of things going back a generation where he had Brett Favre in the prime of his career. He'd also draft guys and then trade them away a couple years later. I mean, is that something you think could happen in order to stockpile some draft picks for the future?
I think so, yeah. I mean, Polian's obviously a savvy guy, and they, you know, the organization is normally pretty successful on draft day, and as I mentioned, looking down the road. So talent is talent, especially at the quarterback position. If you've got a guy, there's always going to be interest, and, you know, you perhaps can gain picks, gain players, use it as trade bait somewhere down the road.
Well, and the one thing we probably should assume, this is a team that only carries two, so Mr. Painter probably doesn't want to be buying any new houses in Indianapolis right now. We will see what happens. Guys, thank you very much. We take a commercial break, and then we get into some more position-by-position breakdowns with the best draft expert around, Nolan Naraki. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly, and we are less than 5 days and counting to the first round of the 2011 NFL Draft. Senior editor Nolan Naraki is the author of our Pro Football Weekly Draft Preview book and our Draft Preview Guide magazine, and probably the most respected independent analyst out there when it comes to the draft. Nolan, we took a look last week at quarterbacks, running backs, and receivers. We'll try and get through the rest of your board in the next 10, 15 minutes or so. Let's start on the offensive line. Centers never at a premium, but at offensive guard, Mike Pouncey and Danny Watkins, the top two players. Probably because Pouncey can also play center and Watkins can also play tackle?
Yeah, their versatility definitely helps him. I think Pouncey's going to be a solid starter. He's nowhere near the player that his brother was a year ago, but he's going to be a solid pick and figures as a first rounder. Watkins, I think, has a chance also to fit there. You know, he played left tackle and has a lot of developmental potential. There's some concerns about his mental ability, and, you know, he has a talent to play center or guard, but, you know, he's likely enough to start off at guard.
Five tackles with first-round grades, a sixth on the cusp, if you will. Anthony Costanzo from Boston College, Gabe Karimi from Wisconsin, Tyron Smith from USC, Nate Solder from Colorado, Derek Sherrod of Mississippi State, almost certainly in the first round. Orlando Franklin from Miami is likely, and maybe Marcus Cannon from TCU. Which of those kids really jumps out at you?
I think Cannon's size really stands out. You know, he's just such a big man, can block out the sun. I think he's going to plug in and be a solid starter as well.
Nolan, we got to talk about the defensive linemen pretty heavily in this draft. Obviously, it seems like the position that is both deepest and has the most talent at the top of the draft. And yet it also seems to me like there's some serious questions with a lot of these guys, too. And we start at the top with the SEC duo of Marcel Darius and Nick Fairley, you know, likely to be the top two interior guys, if you will. Obviously, Darius can play the 3-4 defensive end spot. Talk about weighing those two side by side, their differences, and what do you think the safer of the two picks would be?
I think there's a lot of concerns about both of them from a maturity standpoint. You know, Darius to me is the more well-rounded, complete player. He can play anywhere along the line. I think he's going to be best in gaps. I think both of them would thrive best in as a three techniques and 4-3 defenses. And, you know, I feel more comfortable right now with Darius, but I have concerns about both just with all the production they leave on the field. You know, in a lot of ways, they're both one-year wonders. Darius doesn't... You know, he could have done a lot more, but played through injury this season.
Corey Leggett of Illinois and Christian Ballard of Iowa, two more interior guys with a shot at the first round, but it's at defensive end where I don't know that we've seen this kind of talent at the first round level ever at the position. And, you know, it's interesting, Nolan, because it starts with Daquan Bowers, and I suppose if that knee were healthy, is he the number one overall pick in this draft?
I'd definitely say he'd be up there in the top five, top six picks. I don't know that the Panthers would have taken him number one, even if he were completely healthy. And I think there are enough concerns from teams just that his shelf life is going to be limited. I think they're looking at 3 to 4 years and expecting that he's going to, you know, give teams a hard time. You know, you look at the guys in the past like Courtney Brown, you look at Andre Wadsworth, they were both top five picks, and they both struggled to produce beyond. So I think there are a lot of concerns about Bowers.
Nolan, one of the top mystery men in this draft is Robert Quinn from North Carolina. Obviously did not play last season. look to have, obviously, top 10 talent before that, but still some questions with him. Where do you see him, kind of grade him out a little bit?
He still figures as a top 15 pick. I think there's a chance he'll even go in the top 10. He's got outstanding speed. You know, he tested as well as any defensive end at his pro day, and I think that really helped push him up the boards. There's still concerns about the medical. I've talked to a number of teams who have him off their boards because of the brain tumor that, you know, they're worried about future concussions that could occur. So that, you know, he'll be off some boards, and, you know, he's got to learn to play the run a little bit stronger, but he has a lot of talent, and he could definitely rush the passer.
Nolan, three Big Ten defensive ends likely to go in the first round or, worst case, very high in the second. Two of them, and this is rare, but two players who I am completely confident will completely fulfill their potential. The question is, how much of overachievers can they be? That's J.J. Watt of Wisconsin and Ryan Kerrigan of Purdue, two outstanding young men. And then a third, Adrian Claiborne of Iowa, who is also a fine young man, but who had a surprisingly quiet last year at Iowa. So where do you have these three?
I think they're all going to fit into the top 20. Kerrigan's the guy that is the least talented of the group, but like you said, Watt and Kerrigan, you know exactly what you're getting. They're going to be 10 to 12 year starters in the NFL. You know, whether they're playing in a 3-4 or 4-3 defense, I think they're scheme diverse, and they're both going to be solid pros. Claiborne, you know, he may fall a little bit lower just because of the Herb's palsy in his shoulder. I think there are concerns about it medically, and if anything affects him, I think that's what's going to push him down boards.
A kid that I know you like a lot, Alan Bailey out of Miami of Florida, and a kid a lot of folks haven't heard of, Muhammad Wilkerson of Temple. A couple more very high draft choices at the position.
Yeah, Bailey's really talented. He just got to improve instinctually. I think both of them are a little bit raw in that area, but the sky's the limit in terms of their physical talent.
All right, Nolan, hang on just a second. We've got to get a quick commercial break out of the way, but we're going to look at the linebackers and the DBs coming up next. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Nolan Naraki, Pro Football Weekly's senior editor and lead talent analyst, one of the best independent voices in the country outside of the 32 NFL teams. And Nolan, linebacker, inside linebacker has been a mixed bag for quite some time, but outside linebacker, a position of tremendous strength the last couple of years. Now, Von Miller out of Texas A&M, the highest ranked player on your board, maybe the surest thing in this draft. After that, though, Bruce Carter, Justin Houston, Akeem Ayers, Chris Carter out of Fresno State, inside, you know, Martez Wilson, Quan Sturdivant, nice players. But once you get past Von Miller, there's a lot of risks here, aren't there?
There really is. I think teams are going to be looking hard for 3-4 rush linebackers this year. I think Von Miller is clearly the top. And after that, you're going to see guys like Brooks Reed pushing up from Arizona just because he's safe and teams know exactly what he's going to bring. You know, Ayers, to me, has a lot of potential, but, you know, he was very inconsistent and undisciplined this year, and I think there are concerns that could push him out of the first round because of that.
A little bit of a smaller drop from the top cornerbacks down to some of the mid-range guys, but still, we got to talk about the top guy, Patrick Peterson, followed closely behind by Prince Amukamara from Nebraska. What separates Peterson? I mean, what makes him that much better than some of the rest of the guys at the spot?
I think his size is the thing that stands out the most, the size and physicality, but he's also got the return ability, and, you know, it's rare to find a cornerback that can return the way he can. He's got rare 4.32 speed in the 40, and you don't see that kind of movement skill in a player his size at 6 foot, 219 pounds.
Well, Brandon Harris out of Miami, also pretty much a sure thing in the first round, and then the drop-off really does come. You've got kids like Johnny Patrick and Rasai Dowling, who are nice football players, but almost certainly not first-rounders.
Yeah, Jimmy Smith's the other guy that could fit in that group. He's very talented as a press corner. The big question is whether he's going to be able to fit into the locker room. I think there are some serious character concerns that could push him down the board as well.
No, the safety's really hard to get excited about. Aaron Williams at free safety, a nice player, maybe a late first-rounder. But other than that, the rest of the free safeties, Raheem Moore, Marcus Gilchrist, Eric Hag, you've got Jaquan Jarrett and Joe Lefege and Shiloh Keough and Ahmad Black at strong safeties. But are any of these kids, I guess Aaron Williams is probably a first-rounder. Is that about it at the safety position?
Yeah, that's really it, and he played cornerback at Texas. You know, I think teams are looking at him as a safety, but if you really look at that safety class, there may not be a player in the first three rounds that teams feel comfortable drafting. So I think, you know, there are a lot of good backups in this year's class, some guys that will help you on special teams, but teams looking for safeties this year are just going to be out of luck.
I think one of the guys early in the draft process that people started getting a little excited about athletically was Raheem Moore from UCLA. I know you're not super high on him, and yet he probably still ranks – high on the safety list just because of the dearth of the position. Why do you see him being maybe not as good a football player as he is in his workouts?
I think the lack of physicality is really concerning. I mean, he's another guy that interviewed poorly with teams at the combine, and I think he's slid down boards for that reason. You know, could he go in the second or third round? Yes, but you know, what are you going to get out of him as a pro? That's the big question.
Nolan, an embarrassment of riches on the defensive line. Really nice depth at the top at quarterback. Other than that, you know, offensive line not terrible, but this looks to me to be one of the more questionable drafts, at least in the first round and the first half of the second round, as we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years. Is that a fair analysis?
It's definitely fair, and I think it's the reason Marty Herney's having such a difficult time at the top of this draft. There is no surefire top pick. You know, once Andrew Luck decided to return to school, you know, they were faced with a very difficult decision, and, you know, they're still working through it.
All right, Nolan, and we talk about how difficult that decision is. Now, a lot of people assuming whatever happens with the labor impasse, there will be a rookie wage scale of some kind. Should make some of these picks easier to deal. But again, the problem is that what are you dealing up for, I think?
Yeah, it's the problem every year is those teams at the very top are always waiting for the phone to ring, and they keep waiting and waiting and waiting, and they don't get the calls that they're expecting. So I think, yeah, the teams at the very top are going to have to sit still. I do expect a number of calls, you know, as the draft keeps moving along, because there's a lot of interest moving down, especially in, you know, the later in the top 10, and a lot of teams even in the back of the first round that are going to be moving back into the second.
All right, Nolan, we know a very busy 5 or 6 days coming up for you. Get some rest. We'll talk to Nolan next week. Right now, a quick commercial break, and then the publisher's pen.
And now with the publisher's pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Eric, thank you. And we talked a little bit wrapping up the last segment about the struggles of Marty Herney and the Carolina Panthers, what to do with that first overall pick. The reality is, beyond the lack of talent, or at least depth of talent, in the first round at the top of this draft, is that when you look at the board, there's no question that the best players in this draft are Von Miller and Patrick Peterson and Cam Newton, Nick Fairley, Marcel Darius, Daquan Bowers, A.J. Green, Julio Jones. Those are the 8 best players in this draft. But you look at Bowers with the knee questions, serious character questions about Darius, Fairley, and Cam Newton. You look at A.J. Green, a wide receiver, and Von Miller has to play in a 3-4. Patrick Peterson, a cornerback. You don't want to take those positions with the first or second pick in the draft. Only A.J. Green is the sure thing, and a wide receiver, again, you hesitate high in the draft. So many question marks on the best players, the lack of depth. It makes this the most curious first round we have seen in many, many years. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to Randy Meyer, who does such a great job every week as our executive producer and engineer, to Syndication Networks, our home studio and syndicator, and most of all, our thanks to all of you for listening. We appreciate it so much. Be sure and join us again next week, same time, same station, for more Pro Football Weekly.